Today is Tuesday, December the 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says that the Senate will vote early next year on President Joe Biden's Build Back Better social spending bill, despite opposition from some members of his caucus.
Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, however, is undeterred, and she said notably that the White House will work like hell to get this legislation passed in the new year.
Israeli ministers agree to ban travel to the U.S., Canada, and eight other countries amid the rapid global spread of the Omicron variant. The World Health Organization warns that the COVID-19 pandemic will not end until the unequal distribution of life-saving vaccines between rich and poor countries ends.
None of us want to be here again in 12 months' time, talking about missed opportunities, continued inequity, or new variants.
And in Ethiopia, Tigrayan forces say that they will withdraw to their home territory in an effort to move the year-long conflict toward a negotiated peace. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, two U.S. senators say they have tested positive for COVID-19. AP's Mike Hempen reports.
Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker described their symptoms as mild, saying they have been fully vaccinated with two doses and a booster. Warren says she's regularly tested and turned up negative for COVID-19 last week. She was at the U.S. Capitol last week, along with other senators, as Democrats seek to pass President Biden's Build Back Better social and environment bill. Booker says he's sure he'd be doing much worse if he were not fully vaccinated. Mike Hempen, Washington.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says that the Senate will vote early next year on President Joe Biden's Build Back Better social spending bill, despite opposition from Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. The almost $2 trillion bill will invest in programs to combat climate change, extend health care coverage, and alleviate child poverty. Senator Manchin, who has been a holdout in an evenly divided Senate, said in a television interview this weekend that he would not vote for the bill after months of negotiations between him and the White House. He blamed the White House staff for his decision, saying that they did some inexcusable things. He did not elaborate on what exactly transpired between him and the White House as both sides negotiated a path forward on a bill that has been described as the largest expansion of the social safety net since the 1960s. Anita Powell is VOA's White House correspondent. She joined me to talk about the White House reaction to this news.
So Manchin's move, which the White House described on Sunday as a sudden and inexplicable reversal, it's not just a blow to the agenda that Biden had hoped to get through the Senate by the end of the year or through Congress by the end of the year. It's kind of a slap as well, because if you look at that language from Press Secretary Jen Psaki, this was surprising. And they did everything but call him dishonest, basically, in the statement. They said that he indicated the opposite of what he ended up saying on Fox News, which was that he will not support this piece of legislation. Now that Congress has adjourned for the year, that's where we are at the end of 2021. So right now, you could say that this issue has been put to bed for this calendar year. Okay. And Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, however, is undeterred, and she said notably that the White House will work like hell to get this legislation passed in the new year.
Now, Senator Manchin had multiple conversations or discussions with the White House, including with President Biden. Is it fair to say that the administration was blindsided by his decision to announce his that he's not supporting the bill, and that he did it on Fox News?
Yeah, so just a fun statistical note. In today's press briefing, Jen Psaki took about 50 questions, and fully one-third of those questions were about Joe Manchin about this point. Did you feel blindsided? Was this a slap? And she was very, very diplomatic about that and said, you know, we continue to work with Senator Manchin. He remains a partner and a friend of the president's, and we are hopeful. So Yes, this definitely was a surprise to them, but now they seem to be licking their wounds and saying, okay, now let's pick ourselves up and onward with this purpose.
Now, you said that she was being diplomatic during the press briefing, but the statement yesterday did not seem very diplomatic, so to say.
I think that's a fair assessment of that statement, that it was very blunt. Other media described it as blistering or stunning and things like that. I mean, this is all political theater, right? Yeah. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. But yeah, this has definitely been a pretty high-level, open political disagreement that we're seeing at the highest levels of American government.
The majority leader, Chuck Schumer, indicated that he will bring the bill to the floor early next year. What would that mean, given that we don't know whether he has the full support of his caucus? What is his strategy here?
Right. Well, let's just look at his language in his Dear Colleague letter from this morning. He didn't say he would bring the exact bill back so much as he would try to bring back elements of the bill or try to get the bill through in maybe a different form. And so he's both casting this note of optimism and also trying to keep this top of mind, because, of course, there's an important election happening later in 2022. And the Democrats really have a lot to lose because they only have half of the Senate right now, and they'd like to get more. And they have a number of congresspeople retiring. So the Democrats have to do everything to kind of shore that up and make sure that they still have the confidence of voters. So part of that is probably optics, and part of that is to also see genuinely what sort of initiatives they can push through. Because as the White House maintains, many Americans are in favor of the items and the provisions of the Build Back Better legislation. Things like universal pre-K are pretty well viewed by the majority of Americans, according to polls. Things like expanded access to health care is generally viewed positively by American voters. So they are trying to kind of seize this momentum, but also remind everybody that they came to Congress to pass laws, and this is what they are good for. So, and they do need more, I guess the Democrats feel that they need more in terms of signature achievements to sell themselves to voters later in the year.
That was VOA's White House correspondent, Anita Powell.
Voice of America!
The World Health Organization warns that the COVID-19 pandemic will not end until the unequal distribution of life-saving vaccines between rich and poor countries ends. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In an assessment of the year gone by, WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says the world is still in the grips of a pandemic that shows no sign of going away. He notes more than 3.3 million people have lost their lives to COVID-19 in 2021. That, he says, is more deaths than from HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. He says the odds of this turning around anytime soon are not good. He says there is consistent evidence the new Omicron variant of the coronavirus is spreading significantly faster than the Delta variant. He says it is likely that people who are vaccinated or have recovered from COVID-19 could be infected or reinfected.
None of us want to be here again in 12 months' time, talking about missed opportunities, continued inequity, or new variants. If we are to end the pandemic in the coming year, we must end inequity by ensuring 70% of the population of every country is vaccinated by the middle of next year.
Statistics show at least half of the world's population has received a COVID-19 shot, and the other half has not. People in rich countries have received about 50 times as many vaccine doses as those in the poorer countries. For example, WHO reports just over 10% of people in Africa have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine, compared with 64% in North America and 62% in Europe. Studies show booster shots are effective against the Omicron variant of the virus that causes COVID-19. WHO, however, says boosters should be given to the elderly and people who are immunocompromised and not to those at low risk, such as children. A senior advisor to the Director General, Bruce Aylward, refutes accusations that WHO is against boosters.
What WHO has said very clearly is that we want to make sure that every dose of vaccine used has the best possible impact to get us out of this pandemic. And what we're seeking is equity in the use of vaccines globally. The biggest bang for your buck is vaccinating someone at risk who has not received a dose of the vaccine.
Aylward notes most people who are hospitalized are unvaccinated. He says the goal right now is to make sure everyone gets the first dose before people at low risk get their booster shots. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Israeli ministers agreed to ban travel to the U.S., Canada, and 8 other countries amid the rapid global spread of the Omicron variant. AP's correspondent Julie Walker reports.
A parliamentary committee is expected to give the measure final approval. The rare decision Monday to red list the United States comes amid rising coronavirus infections in Israel. The U.S. will join a growing list of European countries and other destinations to which Israelis are barred from traveling and from which returning travelers must remain in quarantine. Once authorized, the travel ban will take effect midnight Wednesday. I'm Julie Walker.
And in North Korea, the country is about to enter its third year of a severe COVID-19 lockdown. The pandemic measures are devastating the country's economy and look increasingly unsustainable. But no one knows when they will end, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Kim Jong-un in December marked 10 years in power. The coronavirus is among his biggest challenges yet. But while Kim has an impressive arsenal to threaten the United States, he has fewer weapons to fight the pandemic. North Korea is one of only two countries yet to begin coronavirus vaccinations. Instead, its only tool is sealing itself off from the outside world. Ki Park is a North Korea healthcare expert who works at the Massachusetts-based Harvard Medical School.
And it works. Let's face it, the North Korea is able to seal its borders very, very tightly and control movement. And so we know these viruses cannot infect others when they can't move.
In the capital, Pyongyang, foreigners have almost completely left amid a border shutdown. North Koreans are subject to severe travel restrictions within the country. Along North Korea's border with China, trade is at a standstill. Lee Sang-yong, with the Daily NK, a Seoul-based publication, says it's taking a big toll on the economy. He says ordinary people now eat only two meals per day instead of three, and the ratio of rice to corn they consume is 3-7 instead of 7-3. Lee adds, it is clear the economic situation is getting worse. North Korea is reportedly trying to open its border to trade with China, its main economic lifeline. But that is tricky since both countries are embracing a zero-COVID approach. Park Won-gon is a North Korea expert at Seoul's Ewha University.
We are not sure exactly what kind of situation North Korea has faced at this very moment, but it is true that they are seeing very difficulties in near future, especially I think the first half of the next years. They have either opened their border or they have something to break through of these difficulties.
It could mean finally accepting international vaccines or the Pfizer pill, which early results indicate is very effective at combating the virus. But in a pandemic likely seen as a threat to his rule, Kim may instead feel the need to simply assert more control. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
And let's go to the Horn of Africa in Ethiopia, where Tigrayan forces fighting federal troops in Ethiopia say they will withdraw to their home territory in an effort to move the year-long conflict toward a negotiated peace. Gelmo Dawit reports from Addis Ababa.
After months of fighting, forces of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front say they are withdrawing their forces to their home Tigray region. The TPLF forces entered the neighboring Amhara and Afar regions after the Ethiopian government announced a unilateral ceasefire in June. Speaking to Reuters, TPLF spokesperson Gita Chereda said the move is to pave the way for international community to take action regarding the situation in Tigray and for the Ethiopian government to stop using TPLF forces' advancement into Amhara and Afar as a pretext for continued war. So far, the Ethiopian authorities have not commented on the matter, but in Monday's press briefing, the Government Communication Services State Minister spoke of the advance by government forces in North Wollo zone of Amhara region. In a letter addressed to the United Nations Secretary General, Tigray region head Debretsion Gebremichael also made several appeals. He asked the UN to enforce arms embargo on both Ethiopia and Eritrea, and also enforce a no-fly zone, including drones, over the airspace of Tigray. He also expressed his concern for the lives of ethnic Tigrayans living in other parts of Ethiopia. Gebremichael says most Tigrayans across the country are being targeted and arrested, while others still live in fear. According to regional leader, the TPLF wished the earliest to settle the 13-month Tigray conflict, which is taking lives of civilians and inviting proxy war to the region. Gebremichael also shared his concern about the situation in northern and western Tigray, where humanitarian conditions are dire. The UN Security Council is due to discuss on Ethiopia in a session Monday. The UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffiths, is expected to brief the session, which is being held by the request of the United Nations and European nations. The UN says the conflict in northern Ethiopia has exposed over 400,000 people to famine in Tigray and made 9.4 million people dependent on aid. Gelmo Doit for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Voice of America.
And from the Horn of Africa, we go to Australia, where the country's most populous state is being argued to reintroduce COVID-19 restrictions after seeing a record number of new infections. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
New South Wales is relaxing mask and social distancing rules at the same time as coronavirus infections are hitting record numbers. On Monday, Australia's most populous state recorded 2,500 new cases over a 24-hour period. Health officials believe the Omicron variant likely accounts for the majority of those infections. Hospital admissions increased by more than 15% in the same period. Of the 33 people in the state's intensive care units, 26 are unvaccinated, according to the health department. After a week in which the number of cases rose, Australia's political leaders are urging calm and are promising that widespread lockdowns, which have been a feature of the pandemic, won't be reimposed over the holiday season. New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet says his government is taking a sensible approach.
Every day we look at the numbers that are in front of us, the hospitalisations and the ICU presentations, and we'll continue to take a balanced, proportionate and measured response.
The Australian Medical Association said the decision to ease long-standing disease control measures was bizarre timing. Nancy Baxter, a clinical epidemiologist and head of the Melbourne School of Population and Global Health at the University of Melbourne, believes it's too early to relax restrictions.
Basically, we have a big gamble on this being an incredibly mild variant of COVID, because even if it's a bit milder, it's more transmissible and it transmits amongst the vaccinated. So even if it's a bit milder, this is going to be a huge problem for our hospitals and healthcare systems.
Nationally, 90% of eligible Australians are fully vaccinated, according to the health department. And the authorities are urging the community to get a third booster. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And in other news, authorities in Ukraine have placed former President Petro Poroshenko under formal investigation for high treason, accusing him of links to financing separatist forces in the eastern Donbass region. Officials say the accusations against Poroshenko were related to similar charges against pro-Russian lawmaker Viktor Medvedchuk, who has been under house arrest for about 6 months. And in Hong Kong, pro-Beijing candidates swept to victory in the legislative elections that critics described as undemocratic. The turnout in the election hit a record low amid a crackdown on the city's freedoms by China. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while on there, check out our other programs, Upfront Show, Africa 54 TV Show, Straight Talk Africa, and many others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our videos. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. 2021 saw a new migrant crisis on Europe's borders as thousands of asylum seekers from the Middle East and Africa traveled to Belarus and tried to cross the border into Poland and the European Union. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Winter's sub-zero temperatures have not stopped the migrants at Poland's border. This group was rescued from a swamp by Polish soldiers. Medics said they were lucky to survive. Europe has long experienced migrant crises, but the emergency on Poland's border was manufactured, say analysts, with the weaponizing of migrants by Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. Agnieszka Kubal is a migration rights expert at University College London.
In order to retaliate on the support for his political opponents by the EU countries, and also for the sanctions, the set of sanctions that were put by the EU on Belarus in the aftermath of the rigged elections.
Lukashenko relaxed visa restrictions for migrants from the Middle East and South Asia, including Iraq, Syria, and Iran. Europe accused Lukashenko of luring them to Belarus and then directing or even ferrying them to the EU border. Lukashenko denies creating the crisis. The first migrants crossed into Lithuania in July. By August, far greater numbers were gathering on the Polish frontier. Polish authorities moved quickly to reinforce the border, imposing a state of emergency and blocking access to journalists and aid groups. The migrants seeking asylum in Poland were pushed back in often violent confrontations. Belarusian soldiers then forced the migrants back to the frontier, many reported being beaten and threatened with nowhere to go. This migrant did not want to give his name.
As you see, everybody almost dying of the cold, hunger and everything.
Poland accused Belarus of conducting a hybrid war. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki. He said, "We know that this is a fully planned operation which aims to disrupt the sovereignty of our country. Lukashenko's regime uses civilians as weapons of a hybrid war." Poland passed emergency laws to deal with the crisis. Again, analyst Agnieszka Kubal.
It gave priority of pushing people to the border, so the practice of pushbacks over recognizing their asylum claims. On the one hand, Europe seems to be the beacon of human rights and democracy, and on the other hand, it is engaging in those very legally dubious practices.
Europe imposed further sanctions on Belarus. Meanwhile, Russia gave its support to President Lukashenko, blaming Europe for the humanitarian crisis. Geopolitical tensions and migrant pressures have converged to form a new crisis on Europe's eastern flank that looks set to continue into 2022. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In Sudan, hundreds of thousands of people protested Sunday to mark the third anniversary of the uprising that overthrew longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir and to call for civilian rule. Police responded with tear gas, and the doctors' group says at least one protester was killed. Political analysts say the ongoing protests underscore the public's distrust of the military, despite the deal that reinstated the prime minister after an October coup. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
Sudanese protesters have vowed to continue with demonstrations demanding the removal of the military officials from the daily activities of the government. Protesters took to the streets in Khartoum and other cities Sunday, marking 3 years since the start of the uprising that led to the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir. Shakur Nyaketo is a journalist and activist. He says some protesters feel they have not achieved their desired goal of better governance.
Some people are celebrating those other people in the government, but the revolutionaries were not celebrating, but they were protesting because they think that the revolution has been stolen by politicians and it has not given the right of civilian government. So that's why yesterday people were revolting. They were protesting in front of the palace, and it's for the first time that people actually congregation in front of the palace.
The Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors said one person was killed Sunday, making the 28-year-old the 45th person killed since October 25th. The group accused the security forces of using bullets and tear gas to disperse the protesters. The Sunday protest was the ninth big demonstration to take place since the military coup 2 months ago. In October, the military pushed out the civilian-led wing of the government, led by Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok. Last month, Hamdok was reinstated after a deal with the military. Nyaketa says protesters want to see the military out of the country's governance system.
The Sudanese people have announced the revolution to be continuous until the military hand over government. And the only one decision is that Sudanese people don't want any military government. And they have announced the continuous revolt. There is a timetable. Sudanese people will go out on the next 25th of December and 30th of December, and they will continue until April.
However, Hassan Khanenji, head of the Horn Institute for Strategic Studies, says it is not easy to kick out the military.
The only circumstances where perhaps something can change is where there is a lot more widespread protests as opposed to the limited protests, akin to what we saw in Tahrir Square, that may force probably the military leadership to step down in favor perhaps of someone who is more modest, but still from the military, as they work out through this transition plan. But to think that perhaps the military is completely going to go away out of Sudanese politics, right now it's actually a pipe dream. It's not going to happen.
Military leaders have promised to conduct elections in 2023, which will pave way for a civilian-led government. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Malawi's former president Peter Mutharika has accused President Lazarus Chakwera's government of political persecution in arresting former officials linked to the former leader. Mutharika made the comment Sunday at his first large rally of supporters since Chakwera defeated him in elections last year. Lamik Masina reports from Blantyre.
Thousands of supporters of Malawi's opposition Democratic Progressive Party braved rain to attend a rally addressed by party leader Peter Mutharika and political ally Atupele Muluzi, leader of the opposition United Democratic Front in Blantyre. The rally was the first since Mutharika lost last year's rerun presidential election to President Chakwera. Mutharika told the gathering that it is concerning that the Chakwera government is only arresting officials of the former administration's party in the fight against corruption. Mutharika said this is the ploy to silence the opposition.
Last week, did I have any plan?
He says last week we had plans to send my two officials who are experts in economics to address a conference and advise the government on how to turn around economic problems facing the country. But before the day came, they were arrested. Mutharika was referring to the arrest of former finance minister Joseph Mwanamveka and former Reserve Bank governor Dalitso Kabambe. They stand accused of attempting to falsify documents to get funding from the International Monetary Fund. The two were released on bail after being arrested and charged with abuse of office. Mutharika also accused Chakwera's administration of targeting people from the southern region and particularly of Lomwe tribe, to which Mutharika belongs.
Abusa Chakwera.
He says, Reverend Chakwera, you are the man of God. I am pleading with you to stop ill-treating people from the southern region, and also you should stop ill-treating people from the Lomwe tribe because they are innocent. Responding to Mutharika's remarks at the rally, a spokesperson for the governing Tutsi Alliance, Maurice Mutali, told a local daily Monday that Mutharika's remarks are baseless. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great day ahead.